Now that more of the Arctic Ocean is exposed to the sun every summer, could that affect weather in North America, Europe, Russia, Japan, or China? Does the record retreat of Arctic sea ice change weather in the mid-latitudes where billions of people live? Could that help explain strange weather in the Northern Hemisphere in recent years? We all want to know. In 2012, Dr. Jennifer Francis from Rutgers blew the doors off this question. Her paper was published the same year a giant polar storm broke up thin sea ice to create a record low that still stands in 2022. I interviewed Dr. Francis on that paper and again over the years. In 2017, we heard scientist Ivana Sivanovic explain low sea ice was bouncing into the Pacific weather systems, bringing drought to California. That serious drought has persisted for years. But other serious scientists disagree, starting with Mark Cerise, the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado. At the recent COP26 climate gathering in Scotland, senior research scientist Walter Meyer from that center gave a presentation at the Cryosphere Pavilion. Meyer called the connection between low sea ice and mid-latitude weather wishful thinking. Let's hear that. And then we go to yet another strong science paper showing low sea ice is definitely connected in some way to increasing wildfires in the western United States. Dr. Walt Meyer at COP26, November 5, 2021.
The other extremes that people talk about a lot is the mid-latitude connection, the connection between the Arctic and the changes in the sea ice and the Arctic warming and how that may affect the mid-latitudes. And this was a really big paper. Jennifer Francis and Steve Babris in Geophysical Research Letters published in 2012. And this, in our community, I'd say this made a bang. This was, you know, maybe not quite Einstein special relativity level, but this was a pretty big paper and really got a lot of attention. And it got a lot of attention in many ways. First, to kind of just quickly summarize their paper. The idea is, you know, you're warming the Arctic and you're losing sea ice, you're warming the Arctic. That's changing the balance between the warm cold Arctic and the warmer mid-latitudes. And the jet stream kind of is essentially set up by this balance, by the colder Arctic and the warmer mid-latitude. And you can break down, that can break down from time to time as cold air spills out and the jet stream gets kind of wavy instead of being more west to east flow. And the idea is that as you warm the Arctic, that balance is decreasing. So it's more easy for that outflow of that colder air, which is relatively less cold, to spill out and cause this wavy jet stream. And that does is it weakens the jet stream. You get more of a north-south flow instead of a west-to-east flow. That leads to more extreme events. So when you have this wavier jet stream, that allows, you know, air from the south to more easily infiltrate north on the one side, or from the north to infiltrate south. So you can get cold air outbreaks, you can get heat waves. It also tends to slow storm tracks. So you get more extreme events. You get highs that get stuck and you get a heat wave and drought. You can get flooding. You get a storm that moves very slowly as the jet stream doesn't move it out like it normally would. So that's kind of the idea behind that paper and behind the idea of this connection. And like I said, it got a lot of attention at the time, and it still gets a lot of attention. This is just this last winter. It certainly got a lot of press in the United States, especially when anything happens in Texas, it gets a lot of attention in the United States. But when they had the big cold outbreak, record low, it was certainly lowest in many, many years in February 2021, and it caused a big power failure, and people lost power and had pipes breaking and flooding, and I think there are people still recovering from that. So it had a big impact, and it really, it was a cold air outbreak, a very strong cold air outbreak. So, you know, even at this point, there was the connection, or people talked about this, is the warming Arctic and how that was one thing that could be contributing to that. So, you know, is there actually a connection? So this is where it's been an interesting discussion. There's been a lot of talk, but it stirred up a lot of talk and a lot of controversy And particularly from kind of a skeptical community. There were a lot of people that really pushed back and still are pushing back against this, that they don't feel that there's that this connection is really there. Looked at some data, some reanalysis data, and basically correlated these changes in the jet stream with the loss of sea ice and with the warming. And of course, we all know correlation does not mean causation. A lot of folks, especially tropical climatologists, atmospheric dynamics folks that really felt that the Arctic is not a big enough player. It's a smaller area. There's not as much energy, that the tropics are really much more of an influence on the mid latitudes compared to the Arctic. You know, it wasn't just this. Oh, that's this kind of like belief. There was papers that have been published that showed that, you know, no, there isn't a link. They don't find a link depending on what data is looked at. And how it's looked at. So it's gone back and forth for many years. So, but nonetheless, this just came out in September. Judah Cohen's one of the folks that have been pretty big into the research and have found some links between the variability in extreme especially in extreme winters. So this was in September, and saying, yes, there is a link. And, you know, I think one of the things that's a concern is it may be wishful thinking to some degree. Not to say that, like, Jennifer Francis and Steve Babris and others that have found links, that they're making things up or that they're not interpreting the data correctly. I mean, they're really great scientists. You know, I know Jennifer and Steve, and they do great work, and their papers are good. But I think there are things that, depending on how you look at the data, you can come up with different answers. And one of the things is we're looking at extreme events, and extreme events are by their nature rare. And trying to detect a signal in extreme events and a record that's only about 40 years old is very difficult to do. If you've got something that happens only once in a century and it starts to happen and you've changed things so now it happens once every 50 years, well, do you actually see that in a 40-year record? And again, there's this temptation, I think, to in wishful thinking to try to make that connection. And as a scientist, I think we have to always be careful about that. You know, one of the questions, as someone who works in the Arctic, give presentations, especially for sea ice, people in Europe, people in the United States, in the lower 48 United States will say, well, you know, what does this mean for me? And, you know, for Greenland, Antarctica, ice sheet, sea level rise, you can make a connection. For sea ice, it can be hard to do. You know, you can talk about how sea ice is a bellwether. You know, the changes that are happening to sea ice are going to happen to the rest of the globe later. But there's that temptation or desire to really want to say, no, the sea ice loss is going to affect you directly. And so this is this mid-latitude teleconnection is a great thing to make that connection, to say that big snowstorm you had or that big heat wave, that was due to the sea ice or partly due to the sea ice or the Arctic warming. But, you know, it's hard to say if that data is really there yet. But I caveat that also with, you know, you're taking an area roughly the size of Western Europe, the Arctic Ocean, and you're changing it from almost completely ice covered year round to being almost seasonally ice free, at least during the summertime. You know, that's changing the albedo from, you know, 0.7, 0.8 to 0.1. That's a huge change over a big area. And I just don't think you can make that big of a change without having some effect outside of the Arctic. And I think as the changes continue to occur, and as we get a longer record, I think we will start to see some signal outside of the noise. What happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. I do think that is true.
That was research scientist Walt Meyer from the National Snow and Ice Data Center giving a presentation at the Cryosphere Pavilion at COP26, November 5, 2021. Dozens of papers show links between missing sea ice and weather further south. I think Walt Meyer does a disservice by calling that link wishful thinking, like a sales pitch to interest big populations in the south. But that is just part of the downplaying of the real climate emergency typical at these COP meetings and their utter failure to control climate change over the last 25 years. Scientific caution may kill us yet. As Jennifer Francis points out, the observed links between low sea ice and jet stream distortion are just recorded facts. The tough part is to find the links or the drivers to the south. You are about to hear from the lead author of yet another new paper showing those connections from sea ice, this time to western wildfires like the stunning record fires of 2021.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Record-busting, heartbreaking fires have become the new normal in the western United States. Incredibly, new science finds a driver far, far away. The paper is called Increasing Large Wildfires Over the Western United States Linked to Diminishing Sea Ice in the Arctic. How is that possible? The lead author is Dr. Yufei Zhu. Zhu led dozens of papers not just on fire science but on aerosols and air pollution, including in China. Until recently, he was a research scientist at the University of Washington and the Pacific Northwest National Lab. Now, Yufei Zhu brings expertise to a new climate risk company called Kettle. Yufei, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Alex, for having me here.
Well, through smoke and flames and evacuations and closed highways, listeners on the West Coast feel like survivors. How serious is the increase in fire in the western United States?
Well, I don't want to be a whistle of bad news, but those personal experiences and feelings are supported by statistical numbers in multiple fire data sets. And during the past few decades, both numbers and annual burn areas keep increasing over in the western U.S. And the annual average burn areas of large wildfires grew by about 300% between the 1980s and 2010. In 2021, almost 9,000 wildfires burned more than 2.5 million acres in California, making it the second largest fire season right after 2020 on record in California's modern history. So these destructive fires have caused tremendous damage to people's lives and properties. And they also release a large amount of greenhouse gases and toxic aerosols into the atmosphere, posing a serious threat to public safety.
So what are the observed relationships between retreating sea ice in the Arctic Ocean and increasing fires in the western United States?
The Arctic sea ice and regional fire danger conditions are negatively correlated in the observational data sites, with more fire favorable weather conditions in the western U.S. following less sea ice in the Arctic and vice versa. In the meantime, more fires and larger burned areas are observed over in the West U.S. and these fire favorable conditions, like what we experienced in recent years. And this observed relationship motivated our study to investigate the underlying mechanism behind it.
Yes, and to tie these distant actions together so far apart, we need the concept of teleconnection. What is that and how real is it?
The term teleconnection refers to a linkage between weather changes occurring in widely separated regions, like what we are discussing here, and is commonly applied to correlated atmospheric variability on monthly and longer timescales, reflecting large-scale changes in atmospheric waves and jet stream patterns that influence weather over a long distance away. The most famous teleconnection pattern might be in the Southern Oscillation as the atmospheric component of El Nino, which links surface air pressure change between the eastern and the western tropical Pacific regions. And there are many other teleconnection patterns, such as the North Atlantic Oscillation and the Pacific North America patterns, etc., all working together to shape weather conditions we're experiencing.
Does teleconnection operate high in the stratosphere or closer to us in the troposphere?
There are different atmospheric pathways being proposed regarding those teleconnections between the Arctic and the Mid-Atlantic region. In our case, we observed a tropospheric pathway to link atmospheric change in the troposphere driven by Arctic sea ice change to fire weather change over the western U.S.
When we try to anticipate the weather, the public has learned to watch ocean heat conditions in the eastern Pacific called either El Nino or La Nina. How does the Arctic sea ice teleconnection compare in its strength, so to speak, to that?
We do compare this Arctic-related teleconnection with ENSO as the leading mode of climate variability that ties to sea surface temperature change over the eastern tropical Pacific Ocean. And we found comparable impacts of these two teleconnections on regional fair weather between years with minimum and maximum sea ice. However, the strength of ENSO impacts varies year by year with no significant long-term trend, while the strength of the Arctic-related tectonic action shows an increasing trend due to continuous melting sea ice in a warming Arctic. And another difference between these two tectonic actions is that the current generation climate models show better agreement on the variability and influence of the ENSO tectonic action than that of the Arctic tectonic action, suggesting a more challenging job to capture the Arctic-related tectonic action processes in those climate models.
If there's low sea ice during an El Niño year, which is expected to be hotter, does that indicate a possible super fire season? Why were the fires so bad in 2021, which was a La Niña year?
These climate factors could act in a constructive way with boosted effects, but they may also cancel out with each other to result in a neutral effect. The actual impact of either Arctic change or the El Niño La Niña cycle depends on the location we're interested in. So, for example, it is true that El Niño winters are generally warmer than usual in most parts of Canada and the northern tier of the U.S. But for people living in the southern tier of the U.S., like California, they would feel a cooler and wetter winter during El Niño years. And during La Niña phase, these deviations from normal conditions are generally reversed. So therefore, a La Niña year could be bad for fire conditions with more hot and dry weather over in the southern U.S. due to a poleward shifted Pacific jet stream. This is also confirmed by our analysis in the supplementary information of our paper.
How do you know increasing amounts of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are not directly responsible for heating and drying the West, rather than a relationship with Arctic sea ice levels?
The direct effects of greenhouse gases and other anthropogenic forcing were evaluated by comparing the AMAP and AMAP-PF forcing experiments from the CMAP-6 project. These two experiments share the same observation-based surface boundary conditions in sea surface temperature and sea ice, but with different anthropogenic forcing levels of greenhouse gases and aerosols in the atmosphere and land use change. So please note that the difference of these two experiments only isolates the direct climate effects of anthropogenic forcing agents left in the atmosphere and the land, while the indirect effects of these forcing agents are still preserved in the ocean datasets used to drive both experiments. Since the ocean absorbs more than 90% of the heat gained by our planet, it's not surprising that the changes in surface boundary conditions, including both SST and CS change, dominate atmospheric anomalies we saw in our simulations.
You do note in the paper increasing but still controversial evidence of emerging connections between high-latitude environmental change and mid-latitude weather extremes in both warm and cold seasons of the past few decades. Why is this link controversial?
That's because we still have inconsistency in climate modeling results when it comes to the climate impacts of high-latitude environment change. The observational data sites are also relatively short to draw a solid conclusion about actual polar impacts of Arctic change. And I think that's why PEMAP project, which is short for Polar Amplification Model Intercomparison Project, has been initiated in the latest CMAP 6 project to try to narrow down modeling uncertainties and improve our understanding of this phenomena through a coordinated set of numerical models experiments.
And the well-known British researcher James Screen suggests the pattern you describe may change if sea ice is lost across the whole Arctic. A so-called blue ocean event could happen before the year 2050. Let me quote from Carbon Brief here. In the longer term, research by Screen suggests that as global temperatures rise, the risk of severe winters in North America is likely to fall, not rise, if greenhouse gases emissions continue to be high. So as the Arctic continues to warm and sea ice continues to melt, we can't expect its influence on mid-latitude weather to stay the same. Your comment, Dr. Zhu.
Dr. Screen is a well-respected researcher in this field who has done lots of work to resolve the uncertainty. and the linearity of Arctic change and their global impacts. Many previous modeling studies have also suggested nonlinear responses in mid-latitude weather to Arctic sea ice forcing with different intensities. It might be true that the time collection relationship we're talking here will be totally different given an ice-free Arctic. But that's a different question from what we discussed in our paper, as we mainly focused on the past 4 decades as a transient time period when the Arctic is still experiencing drastic change. And Dr. Screen has also clarified the distinctions between these scientific questions in his Can It, Has It, and Will It paper published in 2015. Our paper was inspired by this insightful discussion by focusing on the first two questions from a retrospective view.
I'm reminded of Jennifer Francis of Rutgers. I asked her why some question her theory of changes in the jet stream due to Arctic changes, and she replied she was not advancing a theory. Her work announced relationships between observed data. How much does your new work depend on observations and how much on modeling?
I would say half and half, because all our model-based results were compared against observational and reanalysis data sets before and after removing the long-term trends.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Yufei Zhu. We are looking at how retreating sea ice in the Arctic leads to more wildfires in the West. Yufei, to what extent does your understanding of relationship between Arctic warming and mid-latitude changes build on the work of Radio EcoShock guest Dr. Judah Cohen?
Dr. Cohen is also a well-known scientist in this field, and I learned a lot from his work. I noticed he recently published a paper in Science to highlight the importance of stratospheric polar vortex stretching in linking Arctic variability with extreme winter weather in the U.S. So congratulations to him. Although in this study we proposed a tropospheric pathway that is different from the stratospheric pathway he advocated. This may result from different seasons we studied. The stratosphere responses are usually more prominent in winter when the polar vortex is strong.
Well, the Arctic Ocean is a big place. It is the world's smallest ocean, but it is still 1.5 times the size of the United States. Is this teleconnection coming out of the Arctic as a whole or just part of it?
In our study, we found that the Pacific sector of the Arctic near the Pacific Ocean is the most significant region affecting fair weather conditions in downstream regions like the Western U.S.
And has the change in sea ice affected the length of the fire season as well? Does it extend it to spring or fall?
It could be. Exacerbated fair weather in fall and early winter could extend the length of the fire season. And that could be more dangerous since surface fuels have been fully desiccated after the preceding fire season during summer. And the windy conditions like Santana and the Diablo winds during fall and winter also contribute to this dangerous fair weather condition. So maybe that's why we saw more destructive fires during later seasons in recent years.
Well, yes, the recent urban firestorm near Boulder that burned over 1,000 homes, could that be related to conditions in the Arctic Sea too?
I think it's still too early to draw a solid conclusion here, since it just occurred last week, and I need to do more data analysis before I can answer this question. And I'm sorry for the loss of people who suffered this disaster.
Do your results on declining sea ice cover and western fires apply to Canada as well?
Not really, because our modeling results suggest a warmer but wetter Canada, especially in the northwest coastal region, which leads to suppressed fire activities for most Canadian areas. And similar changes are also evident in reanalysis-based composite results due to poleward-shifted jet streams and storm tracks.
How detailed is this relationship? Does it work with data by decades or right down to the year? For example, the Arctic Report Card from NOAA says sea ice records for 2021 are not record lows, but still among unusually low years. 2021 did see the lowest level of multi-year Arctic sea ice on record. If we know the amount of sea ice, say in June, can that actually help predict how bad the fire season will be in the West that summer and fall?
Yes. This seasonal linkage between the summer Arctic and the fall Western U.S. works on both interdecadal and interannual variations, as shown in our observation-based analysis. And one of our reviewers has also pointed out that this tannin collection relationship is helpful for improving fire predictability on seasonal timescales. But more work needs to be done to integrate this relationship with other influencing factors like atmospheric internal variability and ENSO impacts.
You mentioned that 2015 paper by Barnes and Screen. It was titled "The Impact of Arctic Warming on Mid-Latitude Jet Stream. Can it, has it, will it?" You find affirmative answers for can it and has it, but what about will it? Can it be worse? Yufei, do you expect the trend of more fire weather to continue into the future?
Yes, we actually answered the will it question in another paper published in 2019, and we predicted a near doubled annual burn area change in North America from the 2000s to the 2050s using the same fire model in this study. But that's a synthetic effect driven by all forcing factors, not just by the Arctic change discussed in this paper.
But a doubling of fire by 2050.
Yes.
Well, at least of fire conditions. So in 2021, the government's Oak Ridge National Lab published your proposal to create a new hybrid of machine learning and observations, a kind of open source mechanism for predicting wildfire risk. Is that going to happen?
I hope it will happen sooner than later, but it requires a lot of effort with more resources that are not available at this moment because I recently changed my job.
Yes, you transferred to a San Francisco startup which offers new climate science to help reinsurance companies assess the real fire risk in the western U.S. Did I get that right? Is that what Kettle does?
Yes. Our goal at Kettle here is to balance risk in our changing climate, and we aim at improving fire prediction skills for a better understanding of fire risk in fire-prone regions like California. And we are developing new data-driven fire models based on process-based fire models and tons of observational data and advanced machine learning techniques to achieve this.
Just on a personal level here, a lot of Americans and Canadians used to love summers. Now they fear it, partly because of the fires, the threat of evacuations all the time, and air too smoky to breathe. What can we do to help keep that from getting worse?
I think it requires collaborative efforts of all people living on this planet to address this issue associated with global climate change. And the things we can do in our daily life could be more energy conservation and emission reduction. And we can also try a carbon-neutral lifestyle by following the 3Rs principle to reduce our carbon footprint. And this 3Rs principle generally refers to reduce, reuse, and recycle.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners?
Yeah, thank you all for listening. And it is my greatest pleasure to share with you about our work and thoughts in this program. And wish you all a happy and a healthy new year.
We've been speaking with Dr. Yufei Zhou, lead author of the recent paper in Nature Communications, Increasing Large Wildfires Over the Western United States, Linked to Diminishing Sea Ice in the Arctic. You can find links to follow up more in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Yufei, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you, Alex, for the invitation. Yeah.
I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to this program, and my special thanks to all those listeners who support it. I can't do it without you. Be sure and tune in next week for more of Radio EcoShock. Please take care of your world.